Hi, this is Anthony Pascal.
And this is Laurie Elster.
And welcome to All Access Star Trek.
We are going to be reviewing Lower Decks Episode 7 today, Much Ado About Boimler. But first, we want to talk about the news, starting with the fact that they finally announced the Star Trek panels at New York Comic Con.
There's going to be a double-barreled panel, Star Trek Universe panel. And what's interesting is the panel arrives on October 8th, which is the season finale day of Lower Decks. And there's going to be a Lower Decks group with Mike McMahon and all the voice actors. And
that's going to be like a ready room with Will Wheaton, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. He's moderating that. And so that'll be good. It'll be, you know, I don't expect any news from that, but it'll be a nice recap. They'll probably talk about the finale, which is supposedly amazing and full of action. So I bet there's going to be surprises in that, and they'll probably talk about that. But of course, they're already working on season two, and maybe we'll hear something about that. Hopefully we'll hear when it's arriving. The second panel that they're doing, or second part of this giant panel, is they're going to be doing Star Trek Discovery, which is a week ahead of the premiere of season three. And that has all the actors, including David Ajala, who's new this season, and including Blue DeMario and Ian Alexander, who are also new this season.
Yep. And then the showrunners also, of course, Alex Kurtzman and Michelle Paradise. And they also said there are going to be some surprise guests. So while we were guessing about that, and Trek Movie posted the article that we put together about this, we got some interesting responses on Twitter from members of the writing team from Star Trek Prodigy, the kids show that's going to be on Nickelodeon.
Right. The Hageman brothers, who are putting the show together, and one of the writer producers, were saying, you know, keep your eyes out for this panel. So they're telegraphing that they're going to do something. And I don't know if they are the surprise guests, because to be perfectly honest, to kind of tease surprise guests sounds more like famous celebrities as opposed to people working on Prodigy. So I think we're going to get some Prodigy news, maybe see something of Prodigy for the first time besides a logo.
I hope so.
But I wouldn't be surprised if we get a surprise celebrity guest as well. Maybe Patrick Stewart's going to show up, you know, Anson Mount. You know, because there's nothing for Strange New Worlds or Picard officially as part of the panel. Maybe there's a guest star in season three of Discovery that they're going to tease or show us for the first time. So, you know, it's something to check out. Of course, Trek Movie will be covering it as we do all these big events. But you could tune in live and watch it on October 8th at 12 noon Eastern at 9 a.m. Pacific on the New York Comic Con YouTube channel, and it's free.
Cool. And it's not crowded, because you'll be in your home watching instead of cramming into a room with tons of other people.
Now, another thing that's happened in the last week that was announced on Star Trek Day and has now arrived is a brand new official Star Trek podcast hosted by Tawny Newsome, who's obviously Mariner on Lower Decks. And her co-host for the show is Paul F. Tompkins, who is a well-known voice actor. He does Mr. Peanut Butter on BoJack Horseman, and he's a friend of Tawny's and a huge Star Trek fan. Lori, you've had a chance to listen to the first episode. What did you think?
I did. I was very pleasantly surprised. So I got to be honest, I was not a big fan of the podcast they did around Star Trek Picard. It just felt, it was just a lot of PR and it wasn't particularly engaging to me. This one, what they did was really smart, because instead of trying to do something after each show or interview people from the show, the whole podcast is about interviewing famous Star Trek fans, famous because they're celebrities or just because they're, you know, they have astronauts, politicians, this whole range of people. So it's just about being a fan. I think the two hosts are great. They're really good together and they're funny and warm and have a good rapport. And the first guest was Ben Stiller, who of course has a production company named after a Star Trek episode and has been collecting memorabilia for a long time and is just a funny, smart writer, producer, director guy anyway. So he was very entertaining to listen to and laughing and feeling very nerdy as he described all the things in his collection. But he told a really nice story about Leonard Nimoy giving him a pair of his ears and sweet stuff about his mom taking him around to meet Star Trek people when he was a kid. And he's also just a nice guy. I met him, worked with him once, and he was delightful. So it's good. I recommend it. It's fun to listen to, and it's not a PR thing. It's not just here, listen to how great our show is. It's just different people's experiences. So I'm looking forward to the other guests.
Hmm. I'll check it out. Another piece of news came from TrekMovie.com last week, which was I had an interview with Will Wheaton from Star Trek The Next Generation, who's also the host of the official after show for Star Trek, The Ready Room, which is coming back when Discovery starts up with weekly episodes in 3 or 4 weeks. And we talked about his new movie, and we talked about the new TV shows. And he's such a huge, genuine fan. It's really fun to listen to him. And so I thought we should, let's take a listen to a clip where he and I talk about whether he'd be interested in showing up on Lower Decks. So let's listen to that now. Now, you mentioned Mike from Lower Decks. Now, I don't know if you saw this, but a couple weeks ago, he did a panel, I forget, Metaverse, and he said he'd love to bring Wesley into the show, but he felt he couldn't because Wesley's, quote, like, off with the Traveler. And I'm wondering, do you agree with that canon interpretation of where Wesley is in 2380? And would you do the show, or do you feel like you can't do the show?
I would do the show in a heartbeat. I'm a massive fan. Who says no to Star Trek? Who right. says, no, thank you, I don't want to do Star Trek? Who says that? A dumb person. like, yeah, of course. I would do it in a heartbeat. And honestly, I feel like animation is probably where Wesley could actually exist in his most faithful canonical form right now. In my headcanon, Wesley Crusher is a Time Lord. In my headcanon, Wesley is off of the Traveler. He experienced some kind of multi-dimensional, higher dimensional experience, and it changed him and changed who he is and what he does. And he's a very different kind of character now than he was the last time we saw him. I don't know if that interpretation is the correct interpretation. There is also an interpretation which says none of that stuff ever happened. He went and lived on that planet with all of the people that were trying to be run off by Starfleet, and that's where he stayed. And he would be coming out of that if we saw him again. Ultimately, I am not the person who makes that decision. I don't particularly care about the whatever backstory would be used if one were to be used. I just think it would be fun to put on his spacesuit again and see where he is right now.
And after we talked about that, he also said he would love to come back and do Picard to actually suit up. And would work with Patrick again. So, you know, his enthusiasm is infectious for sure. So, you know, Laurie, what did you think of what Will had to say about Lower Decks and about Star Trek?
I know I'd love to see him on either one. I like him. I think he really had to deal with so much crap about Wesley being annoying in the early days. But I really like the guy, and I like chance that the character could have to sort of redeem himself and show this grown-up version of Wesley.
It is interesting how both he and Mike seem to just be completely ignoring Star Trek Nemesis and kind of focusing on the last time we saw Will was in Star Trek The Next Generation, where he went off to Traveler, and Will says he's now a Time Lord. I mean, it, jokingly, right. Obviously, you know, but that so the kind of brief spotting of Wesley Crusher in the at the wedding apparently doesn't matter, you know, from their point of view.
I mean, I can understand Mike missing that or forgetting about it, but it's hard to imagine Will Wheaton forgetting about it because he was there and he filmed. There's, you know, there's a deleted scene. He's in a whole other scene. So you'd think he might remember that he showed up and was in a uniform and spoke to everybody again.
But he's open to them doing whatever with the character. So if they decided he's back in Starfleet or whatever, sounds like he's, you know, he's not stuck on this whole Time Lord thing. And yeah, I think it'd be fun to see or hear, in either case, Wesley Crusher in Star Trek again. I mean, everyone else is getting a shot at it. Might as well let Wesley have a shot too, right?
Yep. Also, since Gates McFadden is very likely to show up at some point, based on what she said, I'd like to see them together, please.
So it's worth checking out the rest of the interview. It's on the site, and we'll probably post the audio here in the podcast feed later as a supplemental. He talks a lot about the legacy of Wesley and just some other stuff, how he's loving Deep Space Nine, and you know, he's a real fan. Last bit of news to really talk about here is picking up on something we talked about a few weeks ago, which is Viacom CBS have finally announced the rebranding of CBS All Access, and it is, as expected, going to be called Paramount Plus. And they're going to roll that out in early 2021 around the world. So there'll be Paramount Plus in Latin America, Paramount Plus in the Nordic countries, Paramount Plus in the United States and Australia, and then eventually they'll probably get everywhere. I think it's fine. I'm not a big fan of the Plus, but I think picking Paramount was the right move. It obviously is great for Star Trek, you know, because now, you know, Paramount and Star Trek have been together since 1960, I don't know, whenever Gulf Western bought Desilu, which was
68, maybe
67. I don't know. It wasn't exactly the beginning, but almost the beginning of the franchise. So, right. You know, and certainly, you know, how many times have we seen the Paramount logo throughout the decades of Star Trek, both on TV? So it's only in the last few years we've gotten used to thinking of Star Trek as a CBS thing. But, you know, even it's funny when I talk to the actors now, so often when they're talking, they say Paramount when they mean CBS, like, because in their mind, you know, it's all Paramount.
Right.
even though it hasn't been Paramount doing the TV side for years.
Well, they'll be retroactively correct. And if you want more details about that, we've got an article on the site that spells out all their plans.
Right. You know, also when you're on the site, we don't want to get too into it, but last week we talked about our Omega theory. Lori gave a briefing of that, and I wrote up a kind of overly long extended analysis of the, you know, but one of the reasons I did it this way is because I talked to some people, you know, I had a good conversation with Jeff Bond, who is a contributor site, you know, is a huge Star Trek expert. He's written books about Star Trek. And I had to actually talk him through this theory because he didn't exactly remember that episode of Voyager that much, you know, and so, you know, even people who are familiar with Star Trek may forget little details. You know, both of us had to rewatch the episode. So for hardcore Voyager fans, all you need to do is say the burn equals Omega, and they don't even need to read the article. But, you know, if you want to fill in all the details and how it all connects, it's worth checking it out. And it's been really popular. It's been up for a day and it's gotten a huge response. It's been shared all over Reddit. So people seem to be into this theory.
Yeah, and there are lots of comments to sort through to see what people think about sort of picking it apart and saying whether they think it works or not. It's a good deep dive.
One of the funnier comments, and Jeff brought this up too, is, you know, and at a, you know, this is sounds humble bragging again. He said it might be too good of a theory. No, like you know, maybe they, you know, it's like, can we give them this much credit to work all this out? You know, and it got me thinking that, you know, maybe they'll just never explain the burn. Maybe we're right that it, you know, you can't travel at warp, and that explains why the spore drive is important, because they've got to figure out a reason for the Discovery to exist, right?
Right.
You know, so for the new Starfleet to use the Discovery, but maybe they'll never explain. Maybe they'll just say, you know what, you know, warp doesn't work anymore. So, you know, glad you guys showed up. They may never say the words Omega, even though it fits. Well, they may never stay.
The only thing I'm thinking is Kirsten Beyer is still on that team.
Right. If she's in the room, because I don't know what her status is in there, because she was on Picard. I think she did work on Discovery Season 3 as well, but I'm not exactly certain on that. So if she was in the room, there's no way she didn't say Omega.
Right.
So if she's anywhere near the room, they'll mention it. But, you know, if she wasn't, although Bowie and Erica, there's no way Bowie and Erica wouldn't. So, you know, we'll see.
Right. They could be busy with Section 31. Who knows?
No, they were definitely in the room, though, for season three. You know, the last bit is there was another update on Star Trek movies. It's not huge news, but Noah Hawley confirmed, yeah, his project's on hold, and he confirmed he was going to do a whole new crew, but it was going to be somehow tied to the rest of Trek, but he kind of wants to kind of start over. I'm not sure it's a full reboot, and I'm not sure it's ever going to happen because he said it's on hold, so... but it's worth checking out that article and see what he had to say.
Yeah, there's some interesting details in there we hadn't heard before.
So are you ready to talk about Much Ado About Boimler?
I'm so ready to talk about it.
You know, you just watched it yet again. I've watched it a couple times. How many times have you watched it?
Three times.
And you're the most fresh. So what's your fresh take? Because you just watched it again.
I think it's my favorite episode of the season. I thought it was the first one where I was not only laughing at jokes and enjoying the characters, but I was intrigued by the story. There were two main stories. I didn't know where they were going. So I was interested to see what would happen versus just seeing it as a vehicle for fun scenes and jokes. I thought the pace was nice and fast. Reminded me a lot of Futurama in certain moments, which is a high compliment. I thought the guest stars were great and compelling, and they had some good twists. I like when they subvert my expectations, which they did.
Yeah, the writer, M. Willis, this is her first episode with Lower Decks, but she has a lot of experience with animation and a lot of experience with kind of genre shows. Both she worked on The Exorcist and she worked on the show called Helix, which people probably don't remember, but it's kind of this creepy sci-fi show from a few years ago dealing with genetic experiments or so. I kind of forget now, but it was definitely a creepy show. And she definitely has a dark sensibility, which I liked, but it wasn't, you know, dark bad. It was, you know, darkly comic. And I thought that was great. So no, I loved the episode as well. I agree with everything you said. So, you know, usually it's fun to disagree, but I'm not sure if we're going to disagree at all on this one.
Oh, I have one thing we might disagree on.
Okay, well, I can't wait to hear that.
we'll get there.
Now, this episode, as you were saying, it had a couple different things going on. And I think you were saying it essentially has two main stories. It's hard to say what's the main A plot. And I'm not sure there is one. I mean, I might argue that the Mariner story was, which is, I don't know, no. You know what? I can't decide because now I'm thinking maybe it wasn't. So much of this episode was a take on Chain of Command, right?
Yes.
Okay, because again, they're doing their thing where they're playing the hits, right? So the one reason is that if you count, because there were kind of two stories that were very tied to Chain of Command, because you had the whole Mariner thing, where she was dealing with the guest captain. And then you had the kind of tiny story of Freeman, Ransom, and Shax off doing their thing, wearing their Chain of Command outfits.
Taking care of a plant. Growing a seed.
Right. But I loved how everyone was taking it very seriously. Like, they were talking about it like, oh, they're going to plant something. And you're constantly waiting for something to be dramatic. Like, why is everyone acting like this is important, you know? But I think that was the whole point of that whole subplot is, you know, they were just taking things overly serious because sometimes Star Trek takes things overly serious.
Yes.
And I also felt it was a little, I mean, Chain of Command is a fantastic two-part episode of The Next Generation. But when you think about it, it's like, why would Starfleet ever need to take Jean-Luc Picard off a starship and use him as, I mean, I know there was some hand waving in there, but it was just an excuse to do the episode, but it made no sense.
Yeah. Those three in general, they all seemed like odd choices.
Right. That Starfleet even does this because Mariner talks about, oh no, you know, we're getting a guest captain, like as if this is a thing Starfleet does, is every once in a while they're like, oh, we're just going to take your captain and send him on this weird mission. And we've got a guest captain.
Right, like she called it like a substitute captain, a sub-captain, like as if your substitute teacher, like this happens all right. the time.
And of course she, you know, I can't decide whether I liked it or not, because it was like, oh, you know, this is just like Jellicoe. And then she actually says, I don't want a Jellicoe coming in here. And I'm like, I laughed, but I'm like, you know, we already were there. You didn't need to tell us you were there. You know, we already...
That was going to be our point of disagreement, but now it's a point of agreement, because it's the one time that I felt like that was gratuitous. I felt like you don't need to say him because we all know. You know, right. I'm the one who always says, bring on the references. I'm never sick of it. Pile it on. And that one to me, I went, oh, you don't have to name check him. It's more fun if you don't.
Right. Let us get there on our own. And we were there, and then you just came out and said it. And it's like, oh, well, you know, yeah. Now you took all the fun out of it.
Yeah.
But that's a minor quibble over something. And, you know, I'm a huge Jellicoe fan. I'm always on Team Jellicoe. Jellicoe did no wrong.
Don't agree. The best thing Jellicoe did was give Troy a uniform. And, you know, a little smackdown to Riker was maybe justified.
Riker was giving him some lip. I loved how Picard was having none of it. So, yeah, they were being whiny, both, you know, especially Riker. So, you know, I think Jellicoe's great. And I, of course, because I always go on about how they always have these, like, loser captains show, you know, or even worse, the Badmirals. And Jellicoe was just different. He just had a different style. But anyway, that's, now we're going off on a tangent.
Yeah, we'll save that for another podcast.
Another podcast. So, so let's get into the Mariner storyline with her and her friend. And this is, you know, the kind of, it's, yeah, I've talked about this before, like, how old is Mariner? Right?
Right. Because
her friend is a captain.
And they were in the academy together.
Yeah.
So we assume they're about the same age.
Right. And because we've had these things before, like where Mariner worked at Grey Ops, she hung out with the Klingons. You know, I mean, she's got a deep backstory going on. And, you know, so I'm thinking she's at least in her late 20s, if not early 30s, mid 30s
sure.
at this point. You know, it's animation. It's impossible to tell.
Right. You can't look for the telltale signs in her face.
Right. And how, you know, how old is Captain Freeman? You know, is she in her 50s? It's hard to tell, you know. So her mom, right.
But I like this deeper dive into Mariner figuring things out. I thought it was really well done.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Because it exposed some of her weaknesses, as it were, and her issues. It was a lot of, they had a little fun with the whole issue of, is she competent or not, right? Which we've talked about before, and she is, she just doesn't like doing it all the time. And she obviously dials it down on purpose and phones it in because she's afraid of being promoted, which is her biggest issue. And she kind of admits it, that she's got a, you know, she's terrified of being responsible, I think.
Maybe. I mean, it's also, I think as the season goes on, we might find out it's very tied into who her parents are. Her dad's an admiral, her mother's the captain. So maybe she's trying to figure out how to do her own thing. I thought it just introduced a new level of complexity to her without resolving it, which I liked. It sort of raised the question without offering the answer.
Yeah. And it was, but unlike we've seen in some recent episodes where they're kind of just forcing some character development on you and they're like telling you the character development, this was, again, doing it the right way. They were showing you the character development and it was fun and fun, more important, funny along the way. you know, the captain had this whole group of kind of stern lieutenants, and the way they reacted to Mariner was very funny. I'm a huge fan of Maurice LaMarche, who voiced one of them. He voiced the Rigelian, which is kind of a rare alien to see. And he was great, obviously. And he's it's great to see him in Star Trek. I mean, they could bring him back.
He can do anything.
He can do anything. I was kind of surprised they didn't. I mean, I'm switching storylines here, but I'm like, you've got Maurice LaMarche. Why didn't they have him play the specialist?
The Adosian? The guy on the...
Yeah.
No, I totally thought that would have been... I mean, he's, you know, the voice was so familiar already that I wasn't sure if it was him or not, but it wasn't.
Well, the first time it went through, I thought it was, but it turns out it's Fred, I don't know how to pronounce his last name, but Tadaskiore or Tadaskiore?
I don't know. Thanks for the guy, making me do it.
The guy who voices Shax. I mean, a lot of these guys are talented voice actors who are used to doing multiple voices. You know, I was looking at Maurice LaMarche's credits, and, you know, he did 4 different voices in that Star Trek episode of Futurama. including Melvar with 3 L's. So, you know, but I mean, that was, we're still in Mariner. I don't want to jump stories. I think that whole thing, it was kind of, ended well on the, you know, the kind of the creepy ship. That was, you know, another thing, this episode was good at setting up these mysteries and these kind of scare jumps. There was a lot of horror movie elements, which I always thought is a good thing to have in Star Trek. Star Trek started with the man trap. Horror's always been part of Star Trek. And I think this episode really played that well.
Yeah, no, I agree. I was very interested in how the stories came out and was curious about it. And I also thought Mariner showed a little shade of Riker, who didn't want to be, I mean, for very different reasons, but Riker didn't want to be promoted for a while. And that was more because he thought he was on the greatest ship in Starfleet, which he was, let's face it. So with Mariner, it's a different motivation. It seems much more personal about her figuring out who she is. But I like that it's echoed that just a little bit.
Yeah.
And I didn't mind that it was the Farpoint alien. The encounter at Farpoint alien at the end. Had they had the whole story be a big mystery about what it was, and then it was that, I would have been annoyed, because that's not much of a payoff. But in a way, it's like, it wasn't that important, and it was their way of just saying, oh yeah, everything's going to be fine. You recognize this, right? Okay, good.
You know, I thought, before we got to that point, I thought it was kind of the weird sticky monster from that Enterprise episode called Vox Sola. Do you remember that?
Like where they're like in a big web?
Yeah. And I thought that thing, you know, so, which I thought was kind of a deep cut, because it's not exactly the best episode of Enterprise. So I was kind of glad that it turned out to be something a little more iconic than a somewhat forgettable Enterprise reference.
Yeah, and it was, I think, a smart shortcut. Like, that's when you can use Trek knowledge, because for Trek fans watching, okay, yeah, I know which alien this is. And if you're not a Trek fan, you know, you're not super familiar with it and you're watching, you still get the general idea.
And it brings up an intriguing question. Okay, so this is the life cycle. So, you know, so how did the USS Rabido get pregnant? Or whatever, you know, like, how did it, because somehow it transformed into this life form, right? The space jellyfish. So how exactly do these space jellyfish reproduce? How did the ship get infected, or you know what's the right word, but begin to gestate into a space jellyfish? There's a question for M. Willis to answer.
Yeah, I they did a nice job with it, so I was happy with that. Weird, and it's scary when it was grabbing everybody. It was freaky. Like the crew, actually making the crew so freaked out was a nice touch, because we know a normal Starfleet crew is not going to be rattled.
Right. Even the captain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you could hear them crying. Hiding. You could hear male and female voices crying when they found them.
And that's, you know, when Mariner flipped the switch, her, you know, kick-ass space hero switch, and started actually acting like she knew what she was doing. So she obviously knows what she's doing, and she could turn it on or off whenever she feels like it.
Yeah, when there's a real crisis, she stops thinking about herself.
And speaking of scares, the whole Boimler Tendi thing was kind of a you know, more Frankenstein's monster thing. And what's interesting is last episode was essentially that, right? So you had Rutherford create a creation which went horribly wrong, right? Which is badgy. And you'd think, oh God, they're doing that again. But it didn't feel that way. It was more just because it's, you know, and it's more familiar Star Trek tropes, right? So you have two things here. You've got one is Tendi creating a life form, which then turns into something seemingly dangerous. And that's the great thing about the dog, right? Is the dog, it's constantly seemingly terrifying, but it never actually does anything except be adorably scary.
Well, that's what was so good about it. And that it was basically just because she didn't know what a real dog actually was. So that was the joke of that worked out really well, so that everybody else could be horrified when it did these weird things, and she wasn't at all. Also, I have to say, when they asked her, you know, where she found time to do it, and she said, sometimes when I say I'm going to the bathroom, I'm really recoding her DNA. I completely identified with that idea as a working parent of using time in the bathroom to actually get stuff done.
Yeah, I mean,
Tendi, and
Tendi shows she's not a, you know, she may not know what a real dog is, but she knows what she's doing. And they actually threw in some real science terms. Actually looked some of these up.
So
some
did
of these
I.
Genetic coding terms. I'm like, what does that mean? And it's all real stuff. And so she is talented. And she's a lot like Rutherford in that way. She's kind of talented, but there's something a little, you know, she's not ready for the, you know, Geordi LaForge big time, or the, you know, Dr. Crusher big time, but she is definitely got some smarts going on there.
Yeah, and she was very funny.
And then, of course, the other bit of technology gone bad is something we've seen before, but yet it didn't feel like a repeat, which is the transporter experiment going wrong. Brad goes out of phase, which how many times have we seen this before in Star Trek? I mean, I think the first time was Kirk,
with Tholian Webb.
Yeah. Was that the first out of phase? But, you know, every show's done it at least once, right?
Yeah.
The only thing I was kind of, what they didn't do in this one was he was out of phase, but he couldn't put his hand through things. Like, he could grab things, so he still existed. It was they kept on saying it's cosmetic, because there is a joke to be made about the out of phase thing, which is, why can you put your hand through things but you still are standing?
Well, like, that's like Ghost, the movie.
Right,
same issue.
It's not a Star Trek thing. It's every spectral being can somehow, you know, their feet are planted on the ground, but their hands move in and out of things. But, you know, fair enough. But yet, I think that whole thing was great, because it introduced us to the notion that it's, you know, it's not just the Enterprise and Voyager. All across Starfleet, crazy shit is happening to people. And, you know, and there's one group that is responsible for scooping all this crazy shit up and sending them off to this place.
And they looked hilarious. Like, all the freaks on the ship were so funny that every time, like, you have to watch a couple times to check out the ones in the background that you didn't notice before.
Yeah, I mean, they were the kind of, I mean, they had some great obvious ones. the kind of Tuvix-like transporter accident, except, you know, they were more separated and the threshold, like...
Anthony was his name.
Anthony, right. I noticed that. Although they weren't really sure if it was a guy or not. But yeah, there was a guy with a bunch of eyes, and I thought, is that a comment on Saru? Because, you know, the original Saru...
Oh, yeah, was supposed to have all those eyes.
Right. And I thought there might have been, because, again, I'm going to make a Star Wars reference, but I thought there was a creature that looked a lot like a Zabrak to you Star Trek fans out there, Star Wars fans out there. The guy holding his head in his hand.
Oh, okay. Well, there's also someone who had pieces of their head just kind of loosely floating around near the rest of their head.
Exactly. Because there was a little bit of a Star Wars vibe with the specialist. He kind of gave off a little bit of, you know, Emperor Palpatine, you know, maniacal dark vibe. So I thought maybe that was another dark vibe there. I mean, everything about the ship was, you know, kind of this crazy, creepy, you know, definitely not something out of Star Trek. I don't know what the reference was there. I'm going to have to look into that.
Yeah, no, even just calling it the farm, which I feel like is just the generic name that so many TV shows use for a place that's supposed to sound good but isn't. Right. Riverdale is the one most recently that had this whole subplot about the farm, and it was a really bad place. So I think that's a commonly used phrase, and it definitely had the right effect.
But again... Even though, well, okay, and then of course the freaks, they do the thing where they're going to revolt, and you got to love Brad. You know, he's not met a rule he doesn't like. He immediately blabs, you know?
Right?
Which we knew was coming. It's like there's no way Brad's on board with the mutiny. It doesn't, again, you know, his blabbing didn't work out well for him.
No, and I like that the Edosian, the specialist, is that what he doesn't say his name, used two of his three arms to point specifically to Brad. This guy right here, he told me. And two of the arms come out and just start pointing.
Yeah, that was not helpful. The the freaks weren't too cool with Brad. Now, this is where, I mean, this is probably the darkest point of the whole episode is... They went full season three Jonathan Archer on him, where they put him in the airlock, right? And they opened the airlock. They tried to kill him. I mean, that's pretty... Some would argue that stepped over the line. Like, the only reason Brad survived is because it turns out the ship wasn't a... you know, nightmarish hellscape where they're doomed to float eternally through space. They were actually going to a lovely spa.
Right. But I'll say I thought about that too. And then I thought, you know what? These guys have all been in this dark, scary ship as freaks. And so maybe it twisted them psychologically.
Well, right, and the specialist said, you know, maybe these long trips are bad. We should turn on the lights. And
he said, maybe we should paint the ship friendlier colors. Like, they were basically sitting in a cargo hold.
Right. You know, he said to make it less creepy. So he got it. He was cool. He was cool with the mutiny, which I thought was, you know, chillax for someone of his maniacal persuasion. And of course, that was great that he has that, you know, that quintessential evil genius laugh.
And then apologizes which, for it.
Right? So. He's like, hey, it's just how I laugh, you know. So, no, I mean, it was all very meta, but all very funny. That whole subplot, I laughed the most with his thing. We've talked about this, especially when you watch something alone, you really laugh out loud. And when he was introduced, I was literally laughing, and I loved it so much. I loved everything about him.
I liked his cape very much.
Yes. Is that a cape? It's not really a cape. Is it? It's more of a cowl. I'm not sure.
Sure.
On the technical term, because it doesn't, it just went halfway down.
Right.
So,
but it just kind of went over his shoulders.
Yeah. Yeah. No, yeah. It gave him a distinct look. So, yeah, he's a very mysterious character for sure. You know, we've never seen that race since the animated series. He had his own outfit, his own weird ship. He has no name that we know of. He's just the specialist, you know, which is itself kind of scary sounding. So, you know, they were very good at, and this reminds me, and we talked about this in a much earlier episode, the episode where Rutherford's going through all the jobs and they come up to these moments where you think the division head's going to say something scary. And then they're all like very supportive of him. You know, he was another one of those, oh, like this guy is genuinely scary. And in the end, he's just a really nice guy.
Yeah. No,
he
I would,
just wants to help.
I was just thinking I'd love, this is so stupid, but give me a short track on how he got that job.
Right. Or all about division. Was it division 14? Yeah. Division 14.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And the farm, like, do they actually cure people? Like, is Anthony going to get restored? You know, are these people all, or do they just, you know, house all of these freaks there who seem to be happy? And poor Brad gets cured right at the wrong moment and gets kicked out of the spa.
So, poor guy.
He wanted to go back so badly. It was all, you know, I mean, I think we've covered all the different, you know, plots here, but, you know, just getting back, I loved the episode both times I watched it. And again, I found moments where, and it's rare where I laugh out loud, even on the second time, like something I had, there was something I noticed on the second time, which I didn't notice the first time we went through, which I just thought was hilarious. What was the funniest thing for you?
I mean, in terms of lines of dialogue, I had two favorite jokes. And one was what's her name? Ramsay saying, the Borg smell like old trash bags, which she said nobody ever talks about. That right. made me laugh, which, you know, sort of made sense. I assume they don't bathe. So right. That was a funny one. And then when Brad is very upset, Rutherford takes away the sound so that he's not so loud with his phasing, but he says, what if nobody wants a sparkly captain?
Right.
And the way he says sparkly, like an extra syllable. What do you have favorite lines?
Well, I'm not sure if I had. I mean, just everything with everything the specialist said was great. But I think the funniest things I had were some visual gags. One of which was Mariner and Boimler talking and the dog is going by and then the dog transforms into a cube and keeps on going. And they just look at it like, okay, you know, like whatever. The dog's a cube now.
And it was clanking. It was clanking when it was going down the hall.
And then there was a thing when they get to the spa, and I don't know why I thought this was hilarious, but we see Ensign Jenna, I believe, come out and she's in the pike chair, right? But now she's got a fruity drink
on and some the thing. Friends.
And she's got two friends, and by the way, they mentioned that she was suffered from Delta rays, so they got that right.
Yeah.
She's got two pike chair friends. They've all got fruity drinks. And then on her pike chair, they had draped a bikini. And on the two guys, they had Hawaiian shirts, like giant Hawaiian shirts. But they've all got that kind of drooling pike face going. And I don't know. I lost it. Yeah. I thought that was hilarious. And it makes you think, like, yeah, the pike chair probably wasn't unique to pike. There's probably all sorts of people who are suffering all sorts of horrible accidents, and they get those chairs.
And the best they could do was the pike chair with the beeps.
Right. She did beep when she saw the other two guys.
Yeah.
You know, that was her way of saying hello. You know, the farm is pretty nice. And there were other visual gags like that, that, you know, so I think that's one of the fun things. And I think that was very Futurama, as you were saying, obviously.
Yeah. There were even moments that every once in a while, Boimler had a bit of a Philip J. Fry moment, I thought.
Yeah, that's an interesting parallel.
I liked when he was changing his hair, and then he's like, you're not even looking.
Yeah. In addition to all those jokes, the episode was good at being subtle about its Star Trek references, I thought. And we've talked about Threshold and Chain of Command. I thought there was a very subtle one I picked up on. I think I picked up on, which was to the Morse toys, because there was a mention.
Yes, absolutely. I think it was.
So there's a mention of a Professor Saul Rubicek, who had an old special car at Starfleet Academy, which it's got to be a reference to Saul Rubinek, the veteran character actor who played Kivas Vajo in that great episode, The Most Toys.
I love that episode. It's such a good one.
That was my favorite kind of deep cut in the episode.
Yeah, like at first, when they first said his name, I thought, is that because of... And then they said Saul. And I was like, okay, that for sure is him. And that he had some old special car that he loved also made sense because he was a collector.
Yeah. Right.
They also had a Captain Dayton, which made me wonder if it was just named after Dayton Ward, the writer. I wondered about that. That's interesting. And then the only other thing, it's not even a reference to other Trek stuff, but it's... Maybe I'm wrong that it's a recurring theme in Lower Decks, but when they were on the Rebido and all those objects were floating around, one of the things floating around was a banana.
Yeah, I noticed that, and it made me think, because we've seen bananas before, and
yes.
Is this a thing where if we look close, maybe there's a banana in every episode? I don't, because they do that, Psych does that with like a pineapple, and some shows do that. So how many bananas have there been, and should we be looking for them?
Yeah, it made me think that I needed to go back and look for other bananas. Because I remembered one other. So I thought, oh, that's kind of funny that there's a banana in there.
The Rubido is another small community in California. So they're sticking with the California class. Although
The Oakland was the other ship too, right?
Right, which is a much bigger town. It's, but they're running out of, now they've lost two California class ships in 7 episodes. there was a line I forgot that I just wanted to remember because it's so on brand for him when Boimler, because you were saying when he stopped being, making that noise and he goes, Boimler's back, baby, time to kiss some visiting butt. Because he's unabashedly an ass kisser.
Sure.
And, so good.
Yeah. And then I think just in terms of favorite moments from the whole episode overall, I like the dog one for me was the absolute best thing. And the clanking cube was definitely one of them. But the other one was when it suddenly opens this big gaping jaw and bats fly out. And Tendi turns to the dog and says, "You're just a cute little cinnamon roll," as everybody's just horrified. And then later she goes, normal dogs hover and spit lightning, right? Like, it was so good. I loved her sweet innocence and how she just loved the dog no matter what.
And then when she finally meets a dog, she thinks it's gross.
Right, because it licks her.
So, no, yeah, it was all good stuff with the dog. I loved how it had a kind of very sophisticated British accent. And, it was very sweet. You have to wonder because, hopefully this show doesn't get too much into it, but, I want to see the dog again. I want to see the specialist again, but I don't want the show to get too into its own mythology, even where it's just repeating itself. But
yeah,
hopefully we will see Badgie and the dog and, if they're doing the season 2, season 3, I think there'll be plenty of room for these characters to pop in and out. Every once in a while as they build out their roster of characters.
Yeah, I think so. And this time I thought every guest character was strong and funny and helped us get to know our other characters as well. So it was well done. And I didn't love the guest. I loved Badgie, but I didn't love Fletcher last week.
No. Although someone had noticed, this kind of went by us, but Someone on Reddit, I think, noticed that Fletcher had been in all five previous episodes.
Oh, yeah. He's usually, I've seen him in 10 Forward just standing in the background, or their equivalent of 10 Forward, standing in the background for sure.
Yeah. So they were, you know, I don't know if that was planned, because there are some other characters, Jennifer, obviously.
Right.
You know, now it's, I'm always looking for Jennifer and she's always there. And there's a few other characters that we, so I feel like they have characters that we'll probably be learning about later. And that they are showing every week.
Yeah.
It's a big ship.
It is. Is there anything else we need to say, or have we pretty much covered the episode?
I don't know. I love it. You love it. Yeah. Where did we disagree? Did we disagree?
I thought that you were going to like the Jellicoe reference that I didn't like.
No. Of course not.
I thought this was the one time I was going to complain about something that you liked. But nope.
Sorry. I'm subverting your expectations.
Yeah.
So let's talk about our Trek bits. We're done with the episode. Let's move on to our favorite Trek bits. I've just got a brief one. The day that Paramount was trending on Twitter, and I thought, oh, Paramount's trending, and it made me think about the article we did with Gene Roddenberry and Patrick Stewart, which was taken at the dedication of the Roddenberry Building on the Paramount lot, which I've been to, and it's a very boring office building, but for in 1991, it was dedicated, and I thought, oh, you know, why don't I share a picture of that? I started looking for pictures, and I found this amazing picture where it's all the living Star Trek actors in 1991 on both the original series and the Next Generation. And I think it's the only picture of its kind where you have everyone there. So the full casts of both shows and Gene Roddenberry in the middle of them as kind of the proud father. You know, Shatner, Nimoy, Frakes, you know,
a very pregnant Gates McFadden,
everyone, you know.
Yeah.
So it was a wonderful photo, and a lot of people saw it on Twitter. They liked it. I got a great response from Paula Block, who replied that she was standing right next to the photographer, and, you know, joking that it was just another day of life working on the Paramount lot. Paula's a, you know, worked on Star Trek for years. She's written a number of Star Trek reference books, and she's great.
Yeah, she's worth a Twitter follow for sure.
Absolutely. Her and her husband, Terry Erdman.
Yep.
So
they're doing, aren't they the ones doing the new Discovery book?
I think so. We should probably do an interview with them. The DS9 companion was written. Was that just Terry or both of them? I forget, but that's a, you know, essential guide, and Paul has done some essential stuff. So, you know, look them up on Amazon. They're fantastic. So what's your Trek bit of the week?
So mine is Lower Decks based. I was very interested in M. Willis, who wrote this episode, and I started Googling her to see what else she'd done. And I came across this fascinating podcast. So she used to write for She-Ra, which I never watched in its first incarnation, or they did a reboot of it, I guess, that was supposed to be very different. I never watched it, but it was a She-Ra Progressive of Power podcast interview. And when she recorded it, they were writing Lower Decks. They didn't have a premiere date yet. And she talked so much, besides just how delightful it was to listen to her tell stories, even talking about an episode of a show I've never seen. She talked so much about Star Trek. She obviously knows it through and through. She talked about how Deep Space Nine is her favorite show, brought up specific episodes and characters, described that She-Ra episode as the most Star Trek episode they ever did, and then talked a little bit about the Lower Decks team and the kind of fans that they are. So I would say if you are enjoying Lower Decks and you want to know more about the people who make it, it's a very entertaining listen, and I'll post a link to it on the site.
I'll definitely check that out. The only other time I've seen her talk about Star Trek, so we could add a link to this, is we put up the Metaverse panel from, I think, the second week the show was on air, and it was her and Mike, and the director of this episode is kind of one of the regular directors and a couple of the artists, and That was also a good watch for sure to learn more about how the show's made. And she's, you know, pretty interesting person.
Yeah, and I feel like this is not a gloomy, exhausted, frustrated writer's room. This seems like a happy, energetic writer's room if it's got people like her in it.
Although that panel did reveal that she is the one who sometimes suggests some kind of what they said is things that are too dark or too nihilistic. So she obviously has a darker bent to her. And I think that worked well in this episode. But sometimes it sounds like they're like, you know, which is good to know that they're like, nope, that's not, you know, this is Lower Decks and we got to, we're not going to, that, you know, there's a line, I guess. And she walked right up to the line in this episode and did a great job, I thought.
And pushed it out of the airlock.
Exactly. All right.
So I think that's it, right?
That is absolutely it. Thank you all for listening again. Please keep on giving us feedback. We're doing everything we can to make the show better every week. And we come back every Friday. We've got 3 more episodes of Lower Decks. And then we're going to be pivoting right away to Star Trek Discovery.
And we put links to all the news and everything else we've talked about, including just some random things that we may have mentioned, on the website if anyone wants to check them out in more detail.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks. Bye-bye.